fast dying. I'm supposed to believe that was what you wore. Said you were alone, I don't buy it. Now I can't stay.
My friends, my name is Chris, and you are tuned into Canadian Patriot Radio. Today is November 26th, 2022, and we just wrapped up the hearings of the Emergency Commission, or the testimonies of the Emergency Commission. Nothing but lies. Lies and redactions. The Freedom Convoy lawyer, Brendan Miller, was exposing the fact that the government had pretty much did an info dump before some of the main players were to testify, and they redacted huge portions of the emails and text messages and notes of the government. And basically what was exposed through these testimonies was that the government was being greasy. They were being the liberals. The fascists that masquerade as liberals, as always, they weren't disclosing all the info. And you can tell that it frustrated the lawyers on our side. Now, I'm going to open with just a quick story from the National Post. For those of you that followed this, the commission hearings, this will be kind of a good recap for you. What we're going to do today is we're going to go through all the testimonies of your major players. We're going to go with Smirk Guy, Mendocino, Chrystia Freeland, and Justin Trudeau himself, and the PMO's office, being cross-examined by Brendan Miller. And then for some reason, Brendan Miller wasn't present when Justin Trudeau testified. So we'll have to figure out why that happened. But what I want to do first is, for those of you that watch this, this article will be no surprise. The title reads, Firm says claim Executive carried Nazi flag at Freedom Convoy is absurd and threatens lawsuit. This is by Christopher Nardi, and it was written November 21st, 2022. Public affairs firm Enterprise Canada says it's considering suing the Freedom Convoy organizer lawyer at the Emergencies Act inquiry for making what it called an absurd and despicable allegation that one of its senior executives carried a Nazi flag during a Freedom Convoy protest in Ottawa. But Freedom Corp lawyer Brendan Miller says he is protected by privileges from being sued, and he wants two Enterprise Canada executives to testify at the Public Order Emergency Commission about the sighting of a Nazi and Confederate flags during the first week of the Ottawa protest last winter. In a statement, Enterprise Canada senior consultant Andrew Tumulty said Miller made an entirely unsubstantiated and deeply offensive accusation against company principal Brian Fox. There is no truth to this absurd and despicable accusation. Neither Brian Fox nor anyone from Enterprise Canada was in attendance at the Freedom Convoy protests in any capacity, reads the company statement. Tumulty said Fox was in Toronto for the duration of the Ottawa protest and had no involvement in them, and that the company is exploring all legal options and act against this unsubstantiated attack towards Fox. At issue are assertions by Miller during a cross-examination of Canadian or CSIS director David Vigneault that Fox was the man seen walking around Ottawa with a Nazi flag during the Freedom Convoy protest in a photo that is widely circulated online and in the media at the time. At no point did Miller provide evidence of his statement during this cross-examination. Vigneault first responded that he had no point told the inquiry that Fox was the flag bearer. The commissioner, Paul Rollo, cut off Miller before the CSIS director could respond to the question a second time. No, that's not a fair statement, Rollo said to Miller before the latter ended his questioning and walked away from his lectern. Miller later provided a document to the National Post that compares photos of Fox with photos taken at the protest of the Nazi flag bearer's face, which bears few identifiable marks but is almost entirely obscured by sunglasses and shade. The document also claimed that a Toronto Star op-ed critic of the protesters by Enterprise senior counsel Supriya Dwivedi On January 30th was the first appearance online of a specific photo from the protest of the Confederate flag with an image of a truck on it. The photo in question, however, was taken by a photographer for Newswire service Getty Images and is available for use for to subscribers. Mr. Fox and everyone at Enterprise Canada stands firmly against the hatred represented by the symbol Mr. Miller referenced and strived for our workplace to be an exclusive and accepting environment for everyone, reads the Enterprise statement that calls Miller's accusations entirely unsubstantiated and deeply offensive. In a separate statement, Miller said that numerous unnamed people reviewed the pictures of Fox and the Nazi flag bearer, which led him to file an application to the commission to have Fox and Davidi testify at the commission. The commission has not issued a public ruling on the motion. I'm sure being alleged to be orientated with Nazism or the Confederate flag is concerning and upsetting, Miller said. I know so, as it happened to my clients, and it is very upsetting. They have been called Nazis, terrorists, extremists. I have a duty to those clients to leave no stone unturned in dealing with this, and it is our diligence and inquiries that have led us to where we are today. So, there you have it. Was Brian Fox carrying the flag? I don't know. What Miller was trying to basically establish is that it was inside people. It was people inside the government or associated with the government that were planting these flags in the... within the ranks, or not the ranks, but within the crowds of the convoy protesters. Now, the first Confederate flag that was noted in downtown Ottawa was on a truck, I believe it was a Dodge, that had government plates on it. And the woman that took the picture is also associated with the government. So, you know, you guys remember back when there was one guy that was all masked up. He was carrying an actual Nazi flag, and the protesters themselves called him out. You know, they basically said, "You're an agent, get out of here." That's pretty much the story of all of this symbolism that found its way into the protest. It was all planted. Now, I also have firsthand information of, not just by the government, I also have firsthand information of another witness that witnessed CBC. Or allegedly witnessed CBC, got to protect myself here, but they were doing a newscast right where she lives, and CBC rolls up, the cameraman gets out, there's a couple of other people, and lo and behold, up on goes a mask, and they're marching around in the background with a Nazi flag, allegedly. So I don't know, it just seems rather odd. There was nobody that traveled across Canada to go to this protest is associated with Nazism. So it was a stupid play, whoever it was that was doing it. And people that are battling for their rights and freedoms are patriots. They aren't Nazis. The people that are restricting your rights and freedoms align more with Nazism and fascism than the people that are protesting against it. Like, let's be clear about that. So whoever it was, whoever it was that was planting this within the convoy protesters is just greasy. That's what it really comes down to. Will we ever find out? No, we won't. Anyway, my friends, we got a lot of testimonies to get through today, so let's get the show started. We'll be right back. Welcome, friends, to Canadian Patriot Radio, where conspiracy is not theory and political corruption finds the spotlight. We'll be right back. At CPR, we are committed to upholding Canadians' God-given rights to life, liberty, and freedom with all thy sons. Command. Okay, welcome back, my friends. Now we are going to get into the testimony part of the government officials or public servants and the cross-examinations by Brendan Miller and the convoy lawyers. So let's get into the first one. It's Mendocino. It's Smirk Guy. And let's hear how this cross-examination goes, my friends.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
My name is Brendan Miller, and I'm counsel for Freedom Corp, which is the entity of that represents the protesters that were here in Ottawa in January and February of 2022. So, sir, you're a lawyer, correct?
Yes.
And before you were a politician, you were a Crown Prosecutor, is that correct?
Yes.
And you worked for Public Prosecution Services Canada, right?
Yes.
And you worked for Public Prosecution Services Canada for a period of 10 years, is that correct?
That's right.
And you prosecuted terrorism cases, right?
I prosecuted terrorism cases as well as other types of cases, including the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act and other federal statutes. So it wasn't just limited to cases involving national security. There were a broad range of cases that I prosecuted.
And you agree that in prosecuting the terrorism cases, you had to become intimately familiar with national security law, fair to say?
I had to become familiar with the principles around national security, the Anti-Terrorism Act, other statutes that would have implicated national security. Yes, the CSIS Act would be another act as well.
And so included in your knowledge would be the CSIS Act?
Yes.
Right? And that would also include in your knowledge would be the Canada Evidence Act provisions protecting national security as well as criminal investigation information. Is that fair?
Sorry, could you just repeat that last question?
Your intimate knowledge and knowledge as a prosecutor and what you were doing, it would also include the provisions in the case law with respect to the Canada Evidence Act provisions protecting national security as well as criminal investigation information.
Yes, it would.
And as a lawyer, of course, before you testified here today in these proceedings, I take it that you knew you needed to be prepared to testify?
Yes.
And in preparing to testify here today, I assume you reviewed many records and as many as possible.
I spent a fair bit of time, yes, reviewing the documents that were prepared for me in anticipation of this testimony.
Right. And I'm sure you reviewed the numerous statements that you made in public and to Canadians with respect to the protests in Ottawa, as well as the invocation of the Emergencies Act.
I would have done that, yes.
And with respect to preparing for this hearing, and again, as a lawyer, I take it you probably watched all of the evidence given yesterday by the director of CSIS and Minister Blair. Is that fair?
Well, in fact, no, I did not watch the evidence yesterday. In real time, I would have caught some of the headlines and some of the clips, but I was not watching the evidence yesterday. During the day, I have a number of engagements, even on Mondays. So yes, I was not able to watch the evidence in real time yesterday.
So yesterday we had a discussion. I had questioned the director of CSIS. And I asked him the following questions. This is just from the transcript. And I asked him, are you aware of a company called Enterprise Canada? And his answer was, not specifically, no. And then I asked him, and have you identified the individual, the one that is, he was all over the news, the gentleman that was carrying the Nazi flag. Have you identified him yet? And Mr. Vignon responded, said, Mr. Commissioner, as I said before, the specific details of our investigation have been shared, with the commission earlier. I would not be able to go into more specific detail. Were you aware that he said that?
I was not aware that he said that, and I don't know what you're referring to. I'm okay. Sorry.
Well, now I take it that you know, as a former prosecutor with Public Prosecution Services Canada in the realm of national security law, that the identity of a man carrying a flag in public who is photographed in public is not protected by any form of national security law or other evidential protection. Can you agree with that?
I'm sorry. I really don't understand the nature of the question. Could you repeat it?
So I take it that you know, as a former prosecutor with Public Prosecution Services Canada, in the realm of national security law, that the identity of a man carrying a flag in public who has been photographed in public is not protected by any form of national security law or other evidential protection. You know that.
You're suggesting that the identity of an individual is not protected by national security laws? This is what you're asking me?
I'm saying that the identity of an individual whose picture has been taken carrying the Nazi flag in public by someone in the public and posted online, the identity of that person, who he is not protected by national security law, is it?
I have no idea of the, if you're talking about a hypothetical or if you're talking about a real example. I mean, this is a completely okay. abstract
so,
question.
Mr. Clerk, if you could bring up the one document, please.
Yeah, just for record, it's POEHRF.
I think so.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is the individual I'm talking about. It was all over the news. And we've been trying to figure out who he is, and we think we have. Now, again, in looking at this picture, it was posted online, it was in the news, everywhere. And when I asked the director of CSIS about his identity, he didn't say he didn't know. He invoked national security law. But I take it you know, as a former prosecutor with the Public Prosecution Services Canada in the realm of national security law, that the identity of this man carrying the Nazi flag in public, who is photographed in public, is not protected by any form of national security law or other evidential protection. You know that.
Mr. Commissioner, I have an objection to state with respect to the nature of this questioning. In my submission, the placing of this photograph again before the witness in light of the evidence given to date is an abuse of the process of the public hearing process, and that the purpose of my friend putting this document up on the screen is not a good faith purpose. It is apparently for the purpose of asserting claims in order to associate them with the credibility of this public hearing process and distract from the fact-finding process that the important work of this inquiry surrounds. In my submission, there needs to be a good faith basis for the questions put to the witnesses. And this is a further example of what my friend is seeking to do that is not directed to the fact-finding process of this inquiry, respectfully, but to injecting this photograph and other documents into the public light so that they may be commented on, taking advantage of the privileged forum in which my friend is speaking and making assertions to which witnesses repeatedly have had no evidence to give, and there could be no reasonable expectation that they would have relevant evidence to give in response.
Of course, we filed an affidavit.
I'd ask to finish my objection, which I'm almost complete. In my submission, the Commission must respectfully insist that participation be conducted in good faith by those who have been given the right of audience in the form of full party standing and for whom public funding has been recommended for the purposes of enabling their participation to serve the objects of the Commission and their clients' interests. I object to this line of questioning.
Okay. Yes.
Sir, as you know, we filed an affidavit from an individual who identified this man. And the man is Mr. Brian Fox, according to that affidavit. He met him when he was doing, that photo was taken around the same time. He talked to him, he's been identified. There's an application before this commission to call Mr. Fox, as well as to allow our witness, Mr. Sean Folks, to testify. And it is clear, frankly, from the lack of answer and from the objection, that the witness here needs to answer this question. And subject to any questions, sir, those are my submissions.
Okay, well, just going back, I think I suspect you may be functioning under a misapprehension with respect to the testimony of Mr. Vigneault, but that's a different issue which we can get back to, because I think you've misunderstood his answer. So that's something which maybe could be cleared up. With respect to the question, I'll let you continue this. However, the outstanding motion that you've referred to has not been ruled on, and the evidence that you're proposing to tender is not in the public record. So that is not an appropriate, if you like, an appropriate representation at this stage. So, but I'll let you ask the question. I have, because of the outstanding motion at the moment.
Right. So, sir, now again, I take it, you know, as a former prosecutor with Public Prosecution Services Canada in the realm of national security law, that the identity of that man...
Can I just interrupt you? You could just read what the question was to Mr. Vigneault again.
Question, right. Are you aware of a company called Enterprise Canada? Mr. Vigneault, not specifically, no. Question. And have you identified the individual, the one that is there? He was all over the news, the gentleman that was carrying the Nazi flag. Have you identified him yet? Mr. Commissioner, as I said before, we, the specific details of our investigation have been shared, you know, with the commission earlier. I would not be able to go into more specific details. And then I tried to get him to identify that it was the individual, and I was cut off.
Yeah, so I just want to, at my understanding, to try and assist, is that CSIS will neither confirm or deny that they're investigating that, because that's all secret. So what he's answering there is not a refusal to identify, not a refusal to answer. It's because their job is to do investigations. They do not answer those questions. That's my understanding. So I just want to clear that up.
Yeah.
So it isn't that Mr. Vigneault was trying to...
No.
So
okay.
So I think for the record, that's important, and it may assist you. Now, I don't know if Commission Counsel wants to add or whether I've misstated it.
Okay.
To assist Mr. Miller, and as someone who's encountered over about 30 years, similar refusals to answer questions on the basis of national security, I sympathize with his plight. But it is exactly as you described, Mr. Commissioner, the representative of CSIS or another national security officer is typically saying, I refuse to admit or deny, I refuse to acknowledge or disclaim, etc. They're not saying one way or another. They're just saying that as a matter of national security, they can't take a position on it.
Okay. And so if I may ask my question, now I take it that you know, as a former prosecutor with Public Prosecution Services Canada in the realm of national security law, that the identity of the man that was in the photo carrying a flag in public is a photograph in public and is not protected by any form of national security law or other evidential protection. You're aware of that?
I have no idea what this photo is, who the person depicted in that photo is, or any of the other circumstances. This is the first time I have seen this photo produced.
You're aware, and you know, that Mr. Brian Fox was the individual who was walking around in downtown Ottawa carrying a Nazi flag on January 29th, 2022, don't you?
No.
Now, are you aware that Freedom Corp, and you've already heard, has applied to have Mr. Fox testify?
In the commission here?
Yes.
That where the application is? I am not aware of that.
Okay. And you're aware of the company Enterprise Group, is that right?
I believe I have heard of it.
Enterprise Canada?
Yes.
And they do work for the Liberal Party of Canada, is that right?
I do not know.
You don't know?
No.
Weren't they working for the Liberal Party of Canada and political staffers and staff in January and February of 2022?
I don't know.
And I take it you know who local Ottawa freelance photographer David Chan is?
No.
You don't know that David Chan was the official photographer for the Prime Minister, Paul Martin? You didn't know that?
No, I don't know this individual.
And you didn't know that Paul Chan still does freelance work for the Prime Minister, Prime Minister Trudeau? Okay. And you're not aware that Mr. Chan was the individual who took the photos of the person with carrying the Confederate flag?
You put it as a question. Yes. You're trying to make all kinds of statements that are of no assistance to the commission or to this witness.
I will just ask, so are you aware that Katie Telford, the chief of staff for the Prime Minister, has a relationship with Enterprise Group and their staff?
No, I am not aware.
Okay. And I just want to talk to you then about your statements. You had said after and during the invocation, we are listening to law enforcement. According to law enforcement, we need the Emergencies Act. You said that, correct?
Yes.
Right. But law enforcement didn't advise you they needed the Emergencies Act, did they?
Well, I think as you've heard me explain today, I had every reason to believe that law enforcement was supportive and requested the Emergencies Act through the tools that could only be granted through that statute. I've identified the briefings that we received from law enforcement where they identified the gaps in existing authorities and can draw a straight line between the tools that were proposed to us from the RCMP, from the CBSA, to the regulations which then prescribed them, which were then invoked and which were then used to restore public safety.
And you agree that you stated that the Emergencies Act was instrumental in addressing the blockades at ports of entry. Do you remember saying that?
Yes.
But the Emergencies Act wasn't used to remove any of the protesters in the blocks of entry or ports of entry. You're aware?
Well, I would just clarify, as I said earlier, that in fact, it's my understanding that CBSA did use the Emergencies Act powers to prevent two foreign nationals from entering into Canada. And that was exercised under the powers that were granted to them. And that was, again, a direct link to a gap that had been expressed to me and to my colleagues in cabinet. And by invoking the act, we were addressing a gap and what was necessary in the circumstances.
Okay. And you also said that we got advice from our law enforcement that we met the threshold. That advice and the decision to invoke it informed by nonpartisan professionals. Can you agree that no law enforcement ever advised you that the threshold to invoke the Emergencies Act was met? That never happened, did it?
Well, I'd say two things in response. One, we did receive advice from law enforcement very specifically with regards to the tools that were then invoked as part of the Emergencies Act. In fact, as I mentioned earlier today, in the February 13th email that my chief of staff received from Commissioner Lucky, that there was an express link that she drew between those tools, which were, again, we were getting briefed on consistently, and the language of the use of the Emergencies Act. The second thing that I would say is the commission has since heard that a number of our nonpartisan professional independent public servants, including those who operate in the security and intelligence sphere, did advise that the threshold had been met.
Okay. And just two last questions arising from that. Commissioner Lucky, in an email, and it's already in evidence, told you and told your deputy minister, or your chief of staff, actually, that she believed that the Emergencies Act wasn't necessary because they could use the normal laws of Canada to deal with the matter.
My friend's misstating the content of the letter that he's putting to the witness.
Okay. Can you agree that Commissioner Lucky and no law enforcement official, a police officer, advised you that the threshold to invoke the Emergencies Act was met, meaning that there was reasonable and probable grounds or reasonable grounds of a threat to the security of Canada? No one from law enforcement specifically said that to you, did they?
Well, in the broad context of my portfolio, I would disagree with that. And certainly, as you heard from CSIS, the threshold was met.
Okay, so let's recap that testimony and what Brendan Miller was trying to establish. You guys are all smart. You've probably made the connections. And one thing I've noticed about Brendan Miller, what he was doing at this commission was he wasn't necessarily going after the witnesses for specific answers. What he was doing was he was getting things on the record. He was making things public. So what he was doing with this guy that was photographed walking around with a Nazi flag, we don't care who it is. We don't care. What he was trying to establish was the connection between this guy, the company that he allegedly works for, which is Enterprise Canada, their connection to a PMO staffer by the name of Katie Telfer. And then he also, at the very end there, he was trying to establish that the threshold for the Emergencies Act was not met. The CSIS director was very kind of confusing to watch on that. On this, basically, in the CSIS Act, it wasn't met. But from what he understood, there's broader aspects when it comes to the government aspect of the Emergencies Act, and that's how it was passed. So basically, he was influenced by the government to go ahead and say, yes, the Emergencies Act is needed. This is my interpretation of it when he testified. So what he was trying to get Mendocino to do was admit the same thing. Well, Mendocino kind of just turned it back. And that's what this whole thing was, a rigmarole of government officials playing ping pong and bouncing basically credit or accountability off of each other and pretending that they don't have to answer for anything and blah, 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 blah. But when I watched these cross-examinations, I realized quite quickly, as likely you did, Brendan Miller's goal was not necessarily to get answers out of these people. He was trying to get stuff open on the record, on the public record, and he did. He basically gave you a roadmap of where the commands were coming down from for these plants that were carrying Nazi and Confederate symbolism and hateful rhetoric and so on and so forth, where these people came from, through Enterprise Canada, through the PMO's office. That's your chain of command. That's what he established. That's what he put up basically on the public record through the cross-examination of Mark Mendocino. Okay, my friends, let's move on to the next one. This show might be a little bit longer, but we got to get through this because it's all very relevant, and everybody should be aware of what exactly was put on the public record through the questioning of multiple witnesses. Okay, my friends, next up we've got Chrystia Freeland, and this is Brendan Miller's cross-examination of her. Now let's see what he establishes through this cross-examination together, my friends.
Hello, my name is Brendan Miller, and I'm counsel to Freedom Corp, which is the representative of the protesters that were in your city at Ottawa in January and February 2022. So, ma'am, I understand the mandate regarding truckers that led to the protest. It came into effect on January 15th, 2022. Is that correct?
I don't recall the exact date, but I'm prepared to believe you are citing it correctly.
And during the pandemic, from March 20 through January 15th, 2022, there was no such regulation, right?
Again, I don't recall the exact dates myself, but I do know we didn't have the mandate and then it came into force.
Right. And just so the folks at home understand, a regulation is a different type of law. It's passed by the executive branch alone, not by all of Parliament, right? Like the Emergencies Act.
There is absolutely a distinction between things a government can do by regulation and things it can
right.
only do by legislation.
Right. And so would you agree with me that given that during the throes of the pandemic from March 2020 through to January 15th, 2022, and we had no regulation, you didn't need one?
No. I believe that, taken as a whole, the public health measures that Canada put in place were very, very important.
Oh, I understand
the health and safety of Canadians.
I only have so much time, so I'm going to cut you off there. And you'd agree with me that, given that there was no regulation in place from March 2020 through January 15th, 2022, during the throes of the pandemic, there was no reason to pass one in January 15th, 2022, was there? There was no health risk.
No, I'm afraid I don't agree. In January, we had an Omicron wave. We were still fighting COVID, and there was a real value in encouraging as many Canadians as possible to get vaccinated.
But so the purpose was to encourage Canadians to get vaccinated, to compel them to get vaccinated. Is that fair?
That's right.
All right. So that was the purpose of the regulation. That was the true purpose. It wasn't to keep people safe. It was to get them vaccinated.
I believed then, and I believe now, that creating strong incentives for Canadians to be vaccinated protected the health of vaccinated Canadians and protected the health of our country overall.
Okay. So from March 2020 to January 15th, 2022, did you fail to protect Canadians without having that regulation?
Let me start with one aspect of that timeline, which is obviously when COVID first hit us, vaccines didn't exist. And then even when vaccines arrived, it took time for them to be distributed. So, of course, vaccine mandates couldn't be put in place before vaccines existed or were made available.
So, and of course, the government, you ended up creating a vaccine compensation fund in December of 2020. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
Right. And you're aware that Quebec had a vaccine compensation fund and it was the only province that actually had one prior to that?
I am prepared to accept that that's the case. I can't recall specifically.
And can you agree with me that the United States has a federal vaccine compensation fund?
Again, I'm prepared to accept that that's the case.
So from 1867, when Canada was founded, up until December of 2020, Canada had no federal vaccine compensation fund. Can you agree with that?
Again, I'm not an expert in the history of vaccine compensation funds in Canada.
But you can agree the first compensation fund in Canada for vaccines came about only because of the COVID vaccines, correct?
Again, I'm really not an expert in vaccine compensation funds. If the direction of the question is to suggest that the COVID vaccines are more dangerous in some way than previous vaccines we've used in Canada, I'll say one, I'm not a health expert, but I believe very much in really the advice, the effectiveness, the thoroughness of Health Canada.
Okay.
They're very good at judging the
agree.
Safety of vaccines. I have been vaccinated four times. My children have
I understand,
vaccinated.
Ma'am, I don't need to know that.
But it does speak to my confidence in the vaccines.
I understand.
If I've had my children vaccinated, it speaks to my belief that they're safe.
Please stop talking at the clock and let me ask my questions, okay? So,
well, it's a bit of a trade-off. You make a statement and you say, do you agree? And she qualifies the answer.
Yeah.
That's appropriate.
Okay. So, ma'am, if that's the case, then did Health Canada advise you to enact this regulation?
The mandate?
Yeah.
Again, I'm not the health minister, and I'm not going to speak to specific moments that we had advice.
Okay.
But what I will say is we were very careful and thoughtful throughout COVID in the public health measures that we put in place and acted based on advice of PHEC.
Right. And so that mandate was only in place until June of 2022, right?
Again, I can't recall the specific dates, but I'm prepared to accept what you're saying.
We're going to move on and to just another area. I take it you know who Tamara Leach is, right?
I don't know her personally, but I have read about her.
Yeah, and you know who Chris Barber is?
Again, I don't know him personally, but I've read about him.
Yeah, and you know who Tom Morazzo is, right?
Can you say the third name?
Tom Morazzo, the gentleman over there.
I can't say that I know as much about him or I've heard as much about him.
And what about Danny Bulford? You know who he is, correct?
What was that final last
Danny,
name?
Danny Bulford, he used to be with the security team for the RCMP with the Prime Minister.
I'm afraid I'm not so familiar with that final name.
So
Tamara Leach and Chris Barber I've heard of, yes.
And when you were making your decision with respect to invoking the Emergencies Act, you'd already heard about Tamara Leach and Chris Barber?
I had heard of their names, yes.
Yeah, and there's some discussions about them in some of the records. There was issues, you knew who they were.
I had read their names in the media.
Yeah, and you knew about that before you invoked the Emergencies Act.
Again, I can't say 100% not having reviewed what I read, but my recollection is they were reasonably prominent, and so I think it's reasonable to think that I would have read their names.
And of course, you know Tamara Leach, she's a Canadian.
Again, I haven't familiarized myself with her biography before coming here.
She's from Alberta. Do you know that? Where you're from?
I really haven't studied about her before coming here. I want to be careful that I say things I know for sure are true. I am certainly Canadian, and I'm born in Peace River, Alberta.
Okay. Is Tamara Leach a terrorist?
In terms of designating who is a terrorist and who isn't, that is not my job as Minister of Finance or Deputy Prime Minister.
Okay.
We have authorities whose job is to do that.
Right. And so it's not your authority to designate Tamara Leach, Chris Barber, Tom Morazzo, or Danny Bolt for terrorists. That's somebody else has to do that.
Yes, we have intelligence services. We have enforcement agencies whose job is to determine who is a terrorist. And
okay,
that's entirely appropriate.
Can I
say one thing about that?
Yeah, just a second. If I can bring up document ssm.cam.00008764_rel.001, please. And you can, he's pulling that up if you want to add to your answer. Okay, if we can scroll down to page, I believe this is a note with Dave. What page? 12, page 12, please. And this is a note that I understand you wrote with Dave from CSIS. And that's 11. And this is a meeting with Dave from CSIS. And if you scroll down, keep going. Okay. And there you say that you need to designate the group as terrorists. So but it's not your job, but you wanted to designate them as terrorists, right?
So that handwritten note in my notebook, I can assure you that was not a meeting with the director of CSIS, with whom I didn't have a meeting.
It says, it's with David Vignon from CSIS.
It doesn't say that. It says it's with a gentleman called Dave.
Which Dave?
That meeting, that is not an account of
which
a
Dave?
Meeting with Dave Vignon because
which,
I didn't
which
have
Dave
you, a
which,
meeting
which Dave is in
with
those
the
notes,
CSIS
ma'am.
Director.
Which Dave is in those notes? What's Dave's last name?
I need to see my whole notebook that you're referring to, but I can tell you
it
for certain.
It only says Dave.
I can tell you for certain that I did not have a meeting during this time with the CSIS director.
Okay, so
I can exclude that 100%.
This isn't a document. I don't need to bring it up, but you stayed in the House, Mr. Speaker. The members opposite has just used the bad apple excuse. She has excused the desecration of the national. Yes?
My friend is saying he's referring to something that the Deputy Prime Minister said in the House.
Yeah.
There's an objection there for parliamentary privilege.
This is a parliamentary commission. There isn't a parliamentary privilege.
It does exist. Parliamentary privilege
absolutely,
does exist.
It does exist, but because this is a report to Parliament, pursuant to the case I gave you earlier, McIver, it doesn't apply. You can actually ask all of it because we're carrying out a parliamentary function and there's no liability here. It's just a report to Parliament and the Federal Court of Appeal has agreed.
I'm not aware of that.
I gave you the McIver case quite a while ago when we talked about the objections, and it's there.
Well, I'd ask my friend about the document that he's referring to so that we know what he's talking about so we can understand the parliamentary...
This is just a statement from the Deputy Prime Minister in the House. And Mr. Speaker, the members opposite, this is what it says, use just the bad apples excuse. She has excused the decoration...
I think we're going to have to sort this out because I don't think at this stage, and I apologize, I'm not as familiar with you as you are about that case, and clearly the Crown is not either. the government. So I think we're going to have to find that. So I'd like you to hold that.
Okay, I'll come
question.
Back to it. And but you do recall, ma'am, that you had expressed concerns publicly with respect to desecration to national monuments. Is that fair?
I'm going to need advice from my counsel on whether things I said in Parliament I should be speaking about.
Okay, I'll move on. It's okay. So one of the things that happened during the protest in Ottawa dealt with the national monument, the Terry Fox statue. Do you remember reading about that?
I do. Yes, I do remember the Terry Fox statue. I remember discussing it with my children.
Yeah,
they were very upset.
Yeah, and there was in that Terry Fox statue, they put a hat on Terry Fox's head and then put a flag in his arm. And then there was a mandate freedom sign on it.
I don't remember specifically how the Terry Fox statue was implicated in this, but I do remember reading about it. And I remember it specifically because my children were aware of it and were upset.
Right. And so I went online and I just looked at how many times someone's done that to that statue, and it seems to be hundreds. So I'm just going to put this one to you. If someone puts an LGBTQ flag on the Terry Fox statue and flowers in the statue, is that a desecration?
I am not going to go into, I really don't think it's my job or helpful for Canadians for me to go into a discussion of what is okay and not okay.
But you've said it was
Terry
a desecration when you've called it a desecration in public. That was what you were referring to based on what was put on the statute. So is it fair to say that it's only a desecration to you if you don't agree with the message?
Again, you've made a couple of leaps beyond anything that I've said.
That's okay. It's the public record. With respects to, you had said you had concerns for violent actions and interactions with respect to protesters, and I take it that was nationally? You had concerns nationally? Or was it just Ottawa?
I described in my testimony a moment ago two specific areas where I had concern. I was worried about the potential for conflict between angry people in Ottawa and the occupation.
Okay.
Can I finish the answer? Because I have something to add. And as I said in my earlier testimony, and I believe the mayor of Windsor shared this concern, I was concerned about the possibility of that kind of a conflict in Windsor. And I was concerned about the situation in Coutts.
Okay.
Which we heard about at the IRG on this Saturday.
Okay, so, but with respect to the interaction with protesters, I don't know if you heard the testimony of the mayor there, but he said that 75% of his small town supported the blockades and that many of the properties have F. Trudeau flags all over them. So you wouldn't have concern with that specific protest, would you?
My reference to Coutts just now was very specific. At the IRG on Saturday, the 12th of February, the RCMP commissioner raised with us the possibility that there were weapons there. And that was a source of great concern.
Right. And so you can agree that police investigate weapons offenses all over the country every day.
Again, I'm not a police expert, but that seems like a reasonable common sense observation.
So simply because the police know a weapon is somewhere, you can agree with me it's not a national emergency.
The concern about a single weapon somewhere in Canada, and as you say, I think that one weapon being investigated somewhere in Canada, if that were to happen today, certainly.
Right. And you had testified earlier about what you viewed as, you know, ensuring that we as Canadians have a good international reputation so that people come to our country and want to do business with us. Is that fair?
Yes, that's something I was very concerned about.
Okay, and I take it when you consider those sort of things, you look at various reports, and I'm sure you look at various indexes, and I'm sure you look at the Transparency International Index. Is that fair?
I am familiar with the Transparency International Index, but I haven't looked at it recently.
Okay. Well, since 2019, we've began to fall. All right? And we have now come down out of the top 10, and it continues to decline. So can you agree with me that Canada not being transparent hurts our relationship internationally?
I have to say that I disagree with the premise of the question. I think Canada is a very transparent democracy. And in fact, the commission that we're part of right now is a part of Canadian transparency.
Right.
That's why it's important.
And on that point, if I told you that there is a whole bunch of unlawfully redacted documents that we've been fighting over and we're waiting for an order just to get them today, and we haven't had them for this whole proceeding, do you think that's transparent?
Again, and with apologies, I can't agree with the premise of the question. I think that, right. But what I can say is, I think that the fact that this commission exists, that these hearings are being held, that they're public, is really important for Canada and is a measure of Canadian transparency.
Right. And one of your concerns, of course, with transparency and our reputation, was that you would want your government to be as transparent as possible, right?
Again, here, I do believe that transparency and accountability are important, but I also recognize that cabinet confidentiality in many issues needs to be preserved for a reason. And, you know, there are areas where transparency is not appropriate, and I recognize that as well.
Okay. Can you agree with me if, you know, anytime it comes out that the Canadian government has misled Canadians on something, it really hurts our international reputation, doesn't it?
I think that the Canadian government should always seek not to mislead Canadians,
right,
first and foremost, because that's wrong, and that is not the way we should treat Canadians.
And in the many statements that have been said by all the politicians in this matter, one of the main things they talked about, and Justin Trudeau did particularly on the following the first weekend of the invocation of the Emergencies Act, was these horrible, the Nazi flag and all those things that people saw in Ottawa. You heard him say that?
Again, I have to say, prior to coming here, I have not specifically reviewed specific statements of the Prime Minister. If you want to point to a specific one, maybe we could discuss it.
You'd agree if it turned out those flags were linked to your government. That would look really bad for our international reputation, wouldn't it?
Boom. And he just walked. He just did a mic drop. Yeah, I'm not sure if you guys saw that one, but he actually just walked away before she could even answer. So let's recap what he did there. He was trying to establish that the Canadian government didn't have a vaccine competency program up until the COVID vaccines, meaning that the fact that they came in during the COVID vaccines is an indication that the government knew that the COVID vaccines were particularly dangerous or were aware. Now, that's something on the show we've been trying to establish for since these shots rolled about, that who was aware and when, because this is knowingly, this is, you know, that key word knowingly, who knew what about these shots when basically the Pfizer paperwork came out proving that the vaccines were ineffective and actually quite dangerous. World governments were aware of that. There's no way that they wouldn't have been. And that's why this vaccine competency question or line of questioning is very important. He's trying to nail Chrystia Freeland on the knowingly part. And of course, she's a trained politician. She answers with word salad. She won't incriminate herself. That's the one thing they're all quite good at. And then after that, he was trying to establish that Chrystia Freeland was involved in meetings, whether it was with Dave Vigneault or not. The note basically specifically was that he was referring to was pointing out the fact that they were trying to specifically or like single people out and label them terrorists so that they could do the things that they did through the Emergencies Act, you know, like seize their accounts, everything. They could have done everything. So they were brainstorming on how to get these people. So if you rise up against the fascists that masquerade as liberals, they are actively targeting you. That's what he exposed there. They were trying to figure out how to get these people. That's why he was zeroing in on the convoy organizers in particular, because there seemed to be conversations surrounding these people. And then lastly, he went on the attack with Freeland about transparency. Basically, he was exposing, this is the first time we kind of heard through Brendan Miller that the government had dumped a whole bunch of files or basically the requested documentation that was required for proper cross-examinations of these witnesses, and it was all redacted. So he was trying to get her on transparency, and then he kind of just, you seen his frustration where he just... He kind of goes back to the cross-examination of Mendocino, where he was trying to establish the fact that there is a link between certain people that were planted into the crowd with specific symbolism and that the government was aware. So he's designing quite the interesting roadmap for anybody who's paying attention. And like I said, I think his intention is actually to get this stuff on the public record, not necessarily to get the each particular witness to admit certain things, even though if he can catch them, he will. So that's very interesting. Like we've got a, this is going to be a long show, my friends. We've got roughly three more testimonies to go through where... Brendan Miller is present for two of them, and then he's got a relief pitcher in on the very last one, which was Trudeau. So let's carry on with these, and let's see what other pictures he paints for us here. The next one is going to be the PMO's office. And this is Katie Telford. This is Brendan Miller actually going after Katie Telford. She's sitting in the middle, and you can just tell by looking at her that... She's at the heart of a lot of the stuff that's going on. She and you heard Brendan Miller basically name her as the link between Enterprise Canada, which allegedly was employing people to have specific symbolism in the crowd. And there was a link, there was conversations happening allegedly between Katie Telford and Enterprise Canada about this stuff. So let's actually move to the PMO's office and let's watch listen to the cross-examination of Katie Telford and others by Brendan Miller.
Before I begin, I have an issue that I need to address. As you know, and I've made applications several times, the disclosure in the record is entirely deficient. We've been trying to deal with these redactions. There's still redactions for parliamentary privilege, which the government has not removed. There's no legal basis for, as you've already ruled, to redact any document on the basis of parliamentary privilege. There's also the issue, as I've re-raised by email as well, the issue with the notes of this witness, the process that was used in dealing with that needs to be reassessed. These are important witnesses. I need rulings. And so does everyone here. The rulings on the redactions are so important. And for example, Ms. Jody Thomas testified and said that she supported the invocation of the Emergencies Act. But there's a note that we got after we fought for the one redaction we got that said Jody Thomas did not. And it was put up on the screen. It was notes taken. It had one Section 39 redaction on it. So if that's a cabinet document, we can assume cabinet knew about it. And it states that Section 2, no violence, and they were trying to come up with a way how to make this work anyway. That would have been very helpful to have when she was on the stand under oath. This is happening constantly. There is thousands of documents that the DOJ is dumping.
If you can, I'm not looking for a speech. I understand there have been issues about redactions. I believe that one is one I ordered disclosed, and I believe you questioned somebody about it as recently as yesterday or the day before. I am not sure about the redactions, certainly for just to qualify the redactions with respect to parliamentary privilege. I didn't say it doesn't exist. I said it was novel and that the arguments presented were insufficient, and I ordered the three redactions disclosed. We received something, I think it's yesterday or maybe it was even today, and I apologize, I haven't yet ruled on it. That's true. But I do my very best to make decisions. I try my very best to make them intelligent and thoughtful, and that sometimes is not done immediately. So that's sort of how I can respond to those points.
So, sir, I can make it very easy, and we've written your counsel for a set of them. So the law is such that where a redaction is sought on the basis of irrelevance, it is not the onus of the person seeking to have it redacted on the basis of irrelevance. It's the onus on the person seeking for it to be redacted. And the purpose for that is that all of the documents given to us are subject to the implied undertaking rule. So they don't become public until a ruling on their relevance is made.
Okay, well, I'm not in a position to rule on that. I suspect that's the mode of the request you made either yesterday or today, I don't know which, and I'm not in a position to rule on it right now.
Sir, but...
So what sir, I'd like you is if you could proceed with your examination, or that would be, I think, ideal at this stage, and I'll do my best to deal with the motion, the redaction issues, as soon as possible.
Okay, but I just want to put on the record that throughout this entire proceeding, all counsel here, and we're on national television, this is supposed to be completely transparent. This is the purpose of this.
I'm doing my very best.
It's not your fault.
Well,
it's just the fault that nobody's ordering DOJ to actually produce what they're obliged to do.
Well, that's something you can deal with in another forum. I'm doing the best I can here. I think we've gotten a lot of disclosure. There are issues, and we're dealing with those issues that are raised as they are raised. We dealt with the ones you raised, I believe, at the end of last week, made some orders, confirmed some of the redactions, and we'll deal with your most current application.
But could you just not order that the redactions for parliamentary privilege, because I can tell you, I've studied that area in and out, and the reason no one could provide you an authority for the purpose of a redaction on the basis of parliamentary privilege is it doesn't exist. And parliamentary privilege is, of course, an ancient doctrine. And if you would just order the production of the records without those redactions, it would remove a whole bunch of them. Then, if you would order the production of all relevant records with respect to where irrelevant is claimed, those records are then subject to the implied undertaking rule. And there's no national security issue with those. If they were, Section 38 would be claimed. There's no cabinet confidence, because Section 39 is not claimed. And that has been the law since time immemorial. How can you contest if something's relevant if you don't know what it says? And my problem is that this witness is now on the stand. One of the documents is key in my submission. It is the notes of Ms. Jackson, which is the office assistant to this witness. There are redactions therein on the basis of irrelevance, and there are redactions therein also, I believe, on one of the other grounds. And I've sent a written motion if you will, email to your counsel. We've been asking for these things and asking for proper production throughout this proceeding. Counsel are in agreement that we don't have proper production, sir.
Okay, well, I'm not sure you can speak for all counsel, and I'm sure they can speak for themselves as to whether or not you've been asking for this a long time. I'm not aware that you asked about those redactions.
So,
but maybe I don't have the records. But
so, sir,
anyways, we're going to have to stop this.
Yeah.
And despite your belief that the law is always very clear, my experience of 20 years is that's why judges are around. So if you could proceed,
yes.
Otherwise, you know, we're not going to get anywhere. So, right.
So if I could bring up the notes of Ms. Jackson, which are at, so Ms. Telford, Sarah Jackson, she's your office manager, is this correct?
Yes.
All right. And so obviously she's a scribe and does scribing for you when you're in meetings?
No.
All right. So the notes that she takes, she has, if we can scroll down. And down. Right. So that says KT call, and I take it that's you.
KT usually does refer to me.
Right. So she's taking notes of a phone call she has with you?
I don't know.
You don't know. So that's on February 4th. Do you remember February 4th?
Yes.
Okay. So what happened on February 4th?
Well, no, I don't remember in that level of detail.
Okay.
Is there something you're looking for in particular?
Well, I'm trying to find out, because I have to build a record for this. Do you have any idea why anything in your conversation on February 4th in that note would be irrelevant?
I don't know.
And I take it when you spoke to Ms. Telford, or sorry, to this individual at the time, there was no lawyer present, was there?
I don't know what this call is.
Okay, so can we scroll down then? So you see there, the government has claimed solicitor-client privilege, okay? And you don't remember speaking with a lawyer on February 4th, do you?
As I said, I don't know what this call is.
Right, so how would the government know, if you don't know, that this is solicitor-client privileged? They couldn't, could they? So it's redacted, and this is the problem, sir. You have irrelevant.
Is there a question?
Yes, and so if we can scroll down. Okay. And in that note, on February 4th, I know you don't have a good memory, but in your conversation...
So that's a...
No, I know good memory of February 4th. I know she doesn't have a good memory of it, but it wasn't an insult. Blair's current strategy, Emergencies Act, right? So I take it your understanding, she's writing down what you're saying, and you told her that Blair's current strategy is the Emergencies Act. So it was Minister Blair's strategy to invoke the Emergencies Act on February 4th. That's your understanding, isn't it?
No, that's not my understanding.
So what was Blair's current strategy, Emergencies Act, on February 4th, 2022?
I can't speak to what's written here.
You don't remember?
No, if you wanted to pull up notes of mine from February 4th, that might be helpful, but I can't speak to these.
Do you have notes from February 4th?
I have notes from a lot of days that have been provided.
You've been provided? Okay. Have you provided all of them to the Department of Justice?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And would you say that you provided notes from each and every single day?
From any day I have notes on.
Okay. And with respect to this meeting, do you remember what you and Ms. Jackson were talking about?
I unfortunately don't know what meeting she's taking notes from here without more context. It may or may not even be a meeting I was in.
But obviously, you were discussing the Emergencies Act.
The Emergencies Act came up at numerous occasions, as we've said earlier earlier today.
Do you think it would assist the tribunal in this inquiry if Ms. Jackson testifies?
No, I think I can answer any questions you might have.
But you can't answer what that note says.
Is there something you're curious about that note in particular?
Well, on February 4th of 2022, Ms. Jackson, in a conversation with you, writes down Blair's current strategy, Emergencies Act, right? And you hadn't even had an IRG at that point.
I believe you've had an opportunity to speak with Minister Blair.
Yeah, and I put this to him and he said that it wasn't true. So wouldn't it be helpful if you can't remember?
I'm not sure that was correct.
I put the note to him and he said that wasn't his strategy, that's incorrect. That was his evidence.
That doesn't mean it isn't true. I mean, all this note says is Blair's current strategy and Emergency Act underneath it. So
on February 4th, when was the first time that the government came out and spoke that they were considering invoking the Emergencies Act? Do you remember?
Publicly?
Yeah.
I mean, there were questions from the media where ministers were speaking about the Emergencies Act long before it was invoked.
Yeah. And Minister Blair, I discussed this with him, on February 13th, for the first time, he went on a show and he talked about that it was under consideration from the outset. But then when he testified here, he said it wasn't. So was the invocation of the Emergencies Act under consideration from the beginning of the protest in Ottawa?
The Emergencies Act was something that was discussed at the beginning of the pandemic, and it was a public conversation at that time, as well as a private conversation. There were calls for the Prime Minister.
If we can put the document back up, please.
Perhaps it's Brian Gover for the Government of Canada. Perhaps the witness could complete her answer to the question without interruption.
Oh, no, I've just, the document went down. I'm not done. I apologize. So thank you. So, and I understand that there was a consideration of a public welfare emergency, right? That's very different than a public order emergency. You know that. There doesn't have to be a Section 2 security threat, right? And
are you talking about, I'm not sure when you're talking about or
what you're talking about from COVID, because you said it was under consideration then.
They did look at the Emergencies Act at that time, and there was a public call for that at the time, and it was determined because the Prime Minister was very reluctant, as he was during the occupation this past February, to invoke it. And so there's been conversations at various occasions about the Emergencies Act over time.
So when that note's taken on February 4th, 2022, are you saying that you're talking about it in relation to COVID?
I genuinely don't know what this note is, as I've already said to you a few times.
Okay. So if I can scroll up or down, or up, please, or down. We'll go down. Down's fine. Okay, so that says flag to KT February 10th, and it's written in there that this is irrelevant. What does that mean? Why is it irrelevant? Do you know?
I could surmise that flag to Katie means it's probably a bit of a to-do list of things she wanted to flag to me that were obviously deemed irrelevant to what we are talking about today.
Okay, and could we scroll down again? And this one, where it says staff blockade, right? And then it has Section 39 invoked. Do you know what that means?
I don't know why they invoked it there.
Right. And so I take it when you were having this phone call, there was no one else present on the phone other than you and Ms. Jackson, was there?
I don't believe that this is a phone call any longer.
Well, if we scroll back up, this is the second page. It's
yes,
the way it's
said ordered. Flag to Katie at the top.
Flag to Katie. Okay. And so on February 10th, do you remember if Ms. Jackson was in a meeting with Cabinet?
She is not normally in meetings with Cabinet.
So how could Section 39 is a cabinet confidence? So how can, this is the problem. Those are my questions.
Okay, just to recap what Brendan Miller did in this one. Basically, I think he just wanted to get on the record so Canadians were aware of the amount of redactions that they were dealing with. The censorship levels, like when they're scrolling up and down through this letter, between Katie Telford and Ms. Jackson, the whole thing's censored out. Like, the whole thing, and they're invoking parliamentary privilege and irrelevancy and then attorney-client privilege on one specific basically set of notes. And it's I think what he's going after is the fact that Katie Telford was involved with the operation to get plants on the ground, specifically with flags, flag to KT, which would probably bear very negative symbolism. Katie Telford, her smarmy attitude, like she's just one of those people that I'm me personally, I just immediately do not like this person. Like she's just got this arrogance about her that is unbelievable. Secondly, he tried to establish the Emergencies Act timeline. And what she even admitted under oath was that they were trying to get the Emergencies Act through even during like the beginning of the pandemic. So what is the attraction for a supposedly democratic government to enact the War Act? Like, this is just rewording of the War Act. This is martial law, realistically. And they were talking about it at the very beginning of the pandemic. And so what do we all already know? That the blockades at Coutts, the blockades at Windsor were already dismantled by the time they passed this War Act. It would appear to me the reason they passed it was to specifically target individuals that rose up against their fascist government. That is 100% it. And then you hear attitude like Katie Telford has on full display at a public hearings commission about this behavior of her government, and you get this smarmy attitude out of her. So these people believe that they are above you and me. That's what I'm getting at. These people think that there's a set of rules for you and me, all the cattle, and then they're above it, and they get to swing the magic wand that determines how you and I live. And if we have any balls or lady balls to stand up against them, they're going to enact the War Act, and they're going to confiscate your fucking bank accounts. Now let's, unfortunately for the last one, which is Justin Trudeau, we don't have Brendan Miller, but we've got, the relief pitcher comes in and basically questions Trudeau, and she hammers him. It's still very good. So let's listen to this and see what else we can, piece together through this line of questioning at, to the PM.
Bonjour, Mr. Prime Minister.
My name is... Bonjour, Monsieur le Premier Ministre.
The lawyers representing Freedom Corp. and the protesters who were here in Ottawa in January and February of 2022. I want to first talk to you about the events that led up to the invocation of the Emergencies Act. You would agree with me that the Emergencies Act was invoked on Valentine's Day, Monday, February 14th, correct?
Yes.
And you are aware that this commission has received evidence from the police and other witnesses that on Monday, February 14th, the Ambassador Bridge was reopened, as was Coutts. All the borders were reopened, correct?
Yes, and there was concern that more locations were going to be closed. Coutts didn't open till Tuesday.
Okay, well, we'll review the record for that. On the Sunday night, February 13th, there was an IRG meeting, and you were there, and in fact, you were the chair of that meeting, is that correct?
Yes.
And at the IRG meeting, you were advised that there was a breakthrough agreement between the mayor of Ottawa and the convoy organizers to move trucks out of the downtown residential areas. Isn't that correct?
That is not how I remember it, no.
Okay, well, I can advise you that at the inquiry, it was confirmed by the documents your officials filed here and by witnesses, namely Jody Thomas. She confirmed that at that IRG meeting, you were briefed that there was an agreement with the mayor. Is that?
Do
you recall that?
With whom? But with the mayor and who?
Some of the convoy organizers.
Which ones?
Well, Tamara Leach, who's present here in this room, signed a letter. It was made publicly available on the news on Sunday, February 13th, and you were advised of that agreement at the IRG meeting.
And we were also advised that that agreement wasn't holding and that many of the convoy had decried it as fake news and not actually an agreement that they would abide by.
And you learned that on Twitter, is that correct?
No, we learned that at the IRG.
By whom?
By our elected officials.
Thanks. And now you should be aware that this commission has also received evidence from city officials and others that the next day, on Monday the 14th, over 100 protest vehicles had moved out of the downtown residential areas under the mayor's agreement prior to your 4:30 p.m. announcement invoking the Emergencies Act. Is that right?
I can't speak to that, but I'm sure others have or will.
They have. And you are aware of the evidence before this commission from police officials and others who testified that the efforts by the truckers to further vacate the downtown residential areas under the mayor's deal were blocked by the police on both Tuesday and Wednesday, February 15th and 16th. Are you aware of that?
No, I am not. My understanding was the police were allowing anyone who wanted to leave to leave.
Would you agree with me that it would have been a far better outcome if you and your colleagues would have allowed the de-escalation agreement with the mayor to be completed and there would have been no need to invoke the extraordinary powers of the Emergencies Act, including the significant and violent police actions and freezing Canadians' bank accounts?
If I could interrupt, Commissioner, it's Brian Gover on behalf of the Government of Canada. The agreement was to move the protesters to Wellington. My friend is misstating the evidence in my submission.
I could provide some clarity.
Okay, go ahead.
It's very well known in the agreement with the mayor that it was to remove vehicles from the downtown residential areas, and yes, Mr. Gover, thank you, to move to Wellington, but out of residential areas apart from Wellington, so thank you. Can you now, are you able to answer the question?
I believe the answer was no, but you can repeat the question if you like.
Sure. If you had allowed the de-escalation agreement, in other words, moving trucks outside and other protest vehicles outside of the downtown area, there would be no need to invoke the Emergency Act.
Mr. Commissioner, I object again because characterizing this as a de-escalation agreement in my submission is a misnomer. This was an agreement that didn't hold, but it was to move vehicles from residential areas to Wellington Street.
Well, I'll let the question stand. I think it's a question of interpretation. Go ahead.
So, no, I don't agree.
Thank you. Your officials have testified that they were following the convoy as it began moving from regions of Canada towards Ottawa. And you are aware that thousands of Canadians lined the highways and overpasses to cheer the truckers. Is that right?
I can't speak to the number, but yes.
Thank you.
There were many supporters, yes.
Mr. Prime Minister, I would like to read to you an excerpt from three of the many statements that Canadians prepared for this commission, Canadians who supported the convoy and explained why. And I would ask the registrar to bring up document ID HRF 401660. If you could turn to page 274, please. And while that comes up, I'll just start reading the statement. 274. Elizabeth Klapik provided a statement about how the government's COVID mandates and lockdowns disrupted her life. Starting at paragraph 3, she said, "The truckers and the Canadians who lined the roads, overpasses, and highways restored the hope that I had almost lost. These patriotic Canadians told me that I am not alone, that I matter. I will never forget the hope and pride I felt watching these amazing truckers driving along Canadian highways, crowded with patriotic Canadians flying patriotic Canadians flying their flags and holding their signs of support. I will never forget the tears I shed as I regained that almost lost hope, that love for my home and native land, that love for my fellow Canadians. At page 235, Ottawa resident Karen Hanna, who obtained a sociology degree from Ottawa University, starting at paragraph 5, stated, "For months, the leader of our country publicly shamed people like me and my husband. Our own family members turned on us, blamed us, and some even told us we don't deserve health care." Paragraph 17. "One of my most emotional moments was dancing on Rideau Street beside a local man. He had tears streaming down his face. All he wanted was a hug. It was very overpowering for him. I met a girl, 22 years old, who just hopped in her car from Winnipeg and just kept driving. She stayed the entire time. I met people who were like family to me, people who gave up everything to come to Ottawa for justice and an explanation." At page 116, here is one of many, many concerned parents and spouses. Sam Crozier, at paragraph 8, says, "I am not asking for help. I am begging you to please listen, hear my heart, feel my pain, and help work towards the true North, strong and free, that we were promised. My husband, an Army veteran who now has PTSD, and not from anything he has seen or done in the forces, but from what our own government has done. Our government has destroyed my life. I, a once optimistic, full of life person, find myself struggling to stay above water now. I struggle to find joy in anything and daily fear a new announcement being made that will further punish us. I have written the same email to every member of parliament daily and been ignored by a large collection of the people meant to be our leaders, meant to be listening to us. Mr. Prime Minister, you have now heard the statements from some of the many concerned Canadians who felt compelled to support the protesters. Do you now understand the reason so many Canadians came to Ottawa with such resolve in the midst of a harsh, cold Canadian winter because of the harms caused by your government COVID mandates, and they wanted to be heard?"
I am moved, and I was moved as I heard these testimonies, as I saw the depth of hurt and anxiety about the present and the future expressed by so many people. The COVID pandemic was unbelievably difficult on all Canadians. And my job throughout this pandemic was to keep Canadians safe. And the way that I chose to do that was to lean on public health officials, lean on experts and science on the best way to keep Canadians safe. And because Canadians got vaccinated to over 80%, we had fewer deaths in Canada than places that didn't reach that. And every heartbreaking story I hear of a family who sat beside the bed of a loved one dying because they had believed that the vaccines were more dangerous than the disease, I take personally, because I wish I could have done more
to convince people to get vaccinated. But I only have 10 minutes, so thank you. That was helpful.
Just to interrupt you, you're going to have to shorten it because you're already over your time.
Okay, thank you. A number of people have testified in this inquiry referencing your widely published comments and calling the unvaccinated racists and misogynists. And we have heard testimony in this inquiry about how some of your officials wanted to label protesters as terrorists. Would you agree with me that one of the most important roles of a prime minister is to unite Canadians and not divide them by engaging in name calling?
I did not call people who were unvaccinated names. I highlighted there is a difference between people who are hesitant to get vaccinated for any range of reasons and people who deliberately spread misinformation that puts at risk the life and health of their fellow Canadians. And well, my focus every step of the way, and the primary responsibility of a prime minister, is to keep Canadians safe and alive.
Right. So in terms of safety, when you met with, I'll reframe, Minister Blair, Public Safety Minister, Minister Mendicino, National Security Intelligence Advisor Jody Thomas, and RCMP Commissioner Brenda Luckey, and today you testified that the federal government was committed to exhausting all alternatives to a resolution prior to making a decision to invoke the extraordinary powers of the Emergencies Act. Do you agree that that accurately describes your government's position?
That the invocation of the Emergencies Act was a measure of last resort, was not something to be taken lightly.
Thank you.
And something to do when other options were not effective.
And you are aware that the OPP, along with others, developed an engagement proposal, and you were advised of that proposal at the IRG meeting on February 12th, correct?
It was a proposal, but we had, and it was presented to us, we had more questions about how it would actually work. It was not a complete proposal.
My last question, Mr. Prime Minister, when did you and your government start to become so afraid of your own citizens?
So that one is very self-explanatory. She laid out exactly what she was trying to do and establish. The one thing I noted, though, when re-listening to this was the word game that the Government of Canada attorneys are playing. So they really don't like when you refer to the agreement that was made with Ottawa, the city of Ottawa, as a de-escalation agreement. They do not like that. Yet they'll turn around, every one of these elected public servants will turn around and call the protests an occupation. You notice that legalese that they try to play into things, right? This was the furthest thing from an occupation any of us had ever seen. These were the happiest people in the entire world. So they basically established that they used the War Act, the Emergencies Act, to target specific individuals. That's exactly why they passed it. They wanted to make Canadians fearful to stand up against a runaway train tyrannical government, is what they tried to establish. And unfortunately, it worked. Because if they can block you from any type of commerce whatsoever, they can effectively cripple you. So I wanted to bring this all to you. I know a lot of people didn't have the time to listen to these hearings in full, and I wanted to bring all the highlights and what the actual Freedom Convoy lawyers were establishing on the record. And what we know, are you surprised that the fascists that masquerade as liberals didn't actually produce any transparency about the decision-making process that went into this whole rigmarole, and they waited till the last possible second to give disclosure to the other side, and when they did finally get it, it was all redacted. That's what Brendan Miller was establishing. Like, what are we supposed to do with this, really? You know, like, how am I supposed to question witnesses that when everything that I've got that is relevant to this witness is redacted? So that's this whole process was supposed to be a transparent public inquiry as to why the Emergencies Act or the War Act was passed, and we still don't have any answers, and the government's playing games. This is the level of people that are running our country, my friends. So anyway, if you want, listen to this a few times. Listen to each individual's testimony a few times. And there was way more than this, obviously. I just wanted to bring you the top people that, really were the decision makers in this process and show you how they handled a cross-examination, right? Okay, my friends, we are running way over, so we'll shut this one down. Thank you so much for tuning in again, and until next time, in all thy son's command. Hey! Hey! joining us for another episode of Canadian Patriot Radio. CPR is not filmed before a live studio audience. If you like the show, friends, make sure you give us a thumbs up and share us on all your social media platforms. Until next time, take care.